This is episode number 8 of Tech Policy Weekly from the Technology Liberation Front for Thursday, April 12th, 2007. I'm Jerry Brito. Up for discussion this week, more state governments defy Congress and reject real ID. And won't somebody please think of the children? COPPA, .XXX, and the regulation of violence in the media. We'll also talk about other bits that have caught our attention this week. Joining me to discuss these topics are Tech Liberation Front contributors, starting with James Cattuso of the Heritage Foundation. Hi, James.
Hello.
Hello. James is a Skype virgin, so this is his first try on the podcast. Glad to have you.
I feel like I'm on the dating game.
There you go. Tim Lee of the Cato Institute.
Hey, Jerry.
Hey, Tim. And Adam Thier of the Progress and Freedom Foundation.
Hi, Jerry.
Hey, Adam. Our guest this week is Ryan Paul of Ars Technica. Hi, Ryan.
Hello.
Hello. First up, more state governments defy Congress and reject real ID. Ryan, you wrote a piece in Ars this week on a topic. Tell us again briefly what real ID is and what the states are doing.
All right. Well, the real ID act, the function of the act is to create a uniform set of standards for state-issued ID cards. And it also involves creation of a centralized national database that will store information on American citizens. Now, the problem with this is that the act was passed with practically no discussion or debate in Congress. And there are a lot of problems the states have encountered in implementation of the act. I mean, it's practically a financial impossibility, for one thing. And there are significant implications for data theft and identity theft that are also a major concern. And some of the states have started to voice their resistance. New Hampshire representatives voted last week to block implementation of the Real ID Act. And if that bill makes it through the New Hampshire State Senate, New Hampshire will join Idaho and Maine and several other states that have already decided that they won't be implementing the act either.
How many states do you think it'll take before Congress has to go back to the drawing board or get over it?
You know, it's hard to say. One of the New Hampshire representatives said that there are at least 20 states now that are actively looking at banning the proposal, that are considering it. Legislation obviously hasn't been proposed in all those states yet, but I mean the resistance is already so high. I think that it's already time for Congress to start looking at ways to resolve the situation.
And how do you think it can be resolved?
Well, you know, obviously Congress significantly underestimated the implementation costs. I don't think that there's enough money at this point to fund implementation in all these states. It's hard to say what could be done at this point. I think that obviously it's the solution in search of a problem. Considering the fact that the 9/11 hijackers were all legal residents with proper identification, it's not as if it'll actually have an impact on national security. So, you know, I think that some people in Congress need to start asking, is this really the right solution?
You know, it seems to me that we're already past the point where Congress is going to have to do something, because one of the provisions of the Real ID Act bars states that don't implement it are barred from their citizens going on airplanes. And I think even for one state, it's unlikely that Congress would actually let an entire state's population not be, you know, be banned from the airways. And certainly if it's three states, that seems... So at the minimum, Congress is going to have to go back and, you know, change that provision or extend the deadline or something.
Well, they've actually gone back and extended the deadline already. The Department of Homeland Security extended the Real ID deadline to 2009. The original deadline was May 11th, 2008.
Ryan, you talked about a centralized database. What's that have in it?
I don't think there's a lot of public information yet about that. When the ID Act, Real ID Act, was passed, there wasn't even that much specificity regarding how it should be implemented or what it should involve. So it's hard to say exactly what the database will contain. But at the very least, it'll be things like social security numbers.
One of the things that Jim Harper has been talking about a lot recently is that one of the, I believe it's one of the optional things that might be in the database from the DHS guidelines is race and ethnicity. And Jim Harper points out that having a national database of every person in the country with their race and ethnicity you know, just from a civil liberties perspective, is very chilling. And he gives the somewhat hyperbolic example of Rwanda, where the national ID cards with race and ethnicity were used as part of the ethnic cleansing campaign. I think that's obviously kind of alarmist. I don't think we're going to have any ethnic cleansing campaigns here, but certainly it should make us think twice before we have a national database telling what race and ethnicity everybody is.
Well, I think another concern is with security breaches. You look at like just last month, there was a report that the IRS lost something like 490 computers with people's personal financial information. You know, government computer security is so poor that the chances of a database like that being hacked or infiltrated are, it's kind of an alarming possibility in and of itself.
All right, thanks a lot, Ryan. Next up, won't somebody please think of the children? Adam, you've been thinking of the children lately. Tell us about the report on the marketing of violent entertainment to children that the FTC put out today.
Sure, Jerry. Well, I try to think about my own children first and foremost, but it looks like the government's spending a lot of time thinking about all our children these days, because there are so many pieces of legislation or regulation that are floating out there right now talking about, quote-unquote, helping the children, saving the children, and helping parents, whatever, that they're too numerous to count. And the latest to add to the list is today's new report by the Federal Trade Commission about marketing violence to children. And this is a report that's been going on now for several years. And generally speaking, the report tries to discover, you know, is the industry, our media industries, movies, music, video games, are they marketing their content directly to children? Are they selling it to children when it's rated as, say, mature or rated R or explicit lyrics or something like that? Because technically, under the voluntary rating systems that these industries attempt to enforce, they're supposed to avoid selling it to kids under a certain age. So this report has looked into this for the past 5 years, and generally speaking, the reports have been improving over the 5 years, but there are a lot of questions that the report never gets into, like, well, first and foremost, is this not a parental responsibility for us to be deciding on our own as families and parents what our kids actually buy with the money we give them? After all, this media isn't free. It doesn't grow on trees or fall like manna from heaven. So the fact is, you know, when a DVD costs $25 or a new video game from EA Sports costs $60, I have to ask, you know, isn't that the best parental control there is? Because the kid's got to get money from me somehow to buy that. Second of all, this latest FTC report employs a really weird thing called Mystery Shopper Survey. These are not completely unprecedented, of course, but the FTC actually hires teenagers to go into stores, give them money, and to try to buy video games or movies or music rated above their age level. As I pointed out in my blog on the Tech Liberation Front today, you know, where was the jobs at when I was a teenager? I would have loved to have this job. What a great gig to get, you know, be paid to go buy, you know, media content. Regardless, that's how they get these numbers about whether or not these voluntary parental controls or rating systems are working. Again, they're improving, but the FTC seems to suggest that, well, the stores need to do better, the content companies need to do better. The problem is not every retailer is going to be perfect on this. There's going to be some slips. There's going to be some younger people who work at the counter or let a kid buy a game that's, you know, rated M for mature or a movie rated R. So it's never going to be perfect, but this obviously is the kind of thing that the government uses to justify further regulation of media. And what specifically could come out of this effort is the sort of bill we saw a few years ago by Joe Lieberman and Senator Fritz Hollings called the Media Accountability Act, where the government tries to, quote-unquote, put teeth in voluntary rating systems by basically having federal enforcement of them. Luckily, the courts, I don't think, are going to allow that to pass muster. In fact, constitutionally, we know it won't pass muster. But that's the kind of games that Washington will be playing on this front.
Adam, what's the evidence on the effect of violent video games on children?
Well, as you can imagine, it's sort of all over the board. These psychological studies that are done about trying to measure, quote-unquote, media effects or violent effects of media content on kids are notoriously schizophrenic. It's really almost any conclusion you want to find, you can find a study that proves it. And the problem I have with all of this is that the way these studies are done in a lab is an extraordinarily artificial experience. I mean, they bring kids in, they set them down once and say, guess what, you're going to play some video games. One sample group plays, you know, Duke Nukem, or one other group plays, you know, something with Blues Clues in it. And then they're told to come into another room and take, like, a punching bag and see what they do with it. It's like, come on, this is not normal. This is not the way the real world works. You can't draw conclusions from these things, and yet serious social scientists and psychologists do draw conclusions from that, like, oh, kids are going to be, you know, mindlessly violent once they watch or play these games. The one thing I do know, and this is a fact that I try to stress in everything I write about media violence, whether it's televised or video game, over the past 10 years, according to Federal Bureau of Investigation statistics, we have seen a 39% drop in juvenile violence in this country. The biggest portion of that drop has been a 62% drop in the juvenile murder rate. So if you want to tell me that those studies are telling us that we're all going to, you know, engage in, you know, mass murder once we play a violent video game or watch a violent movie, all I have to say is look at the stats, because they don't reflect that. So that theory has some problems. Regardless, I think government regulation is coming on this front. Within the next 2 weeks, the Federal Communications Commission is set to release a report about regulating excessive violence, quote-unquote, not just on broadcast television, but on cable and satellite television as well. And we've discussed that on the blog before and in previous podcasts. So stay tuned on this front.
James, you've also had children on your mind lately, and you're going to soon be releasing a paper on the Child Online Protection Act. What's going on there, and what other issues are there?
That's right. The issues are very similar. The issues are very similar to those that Adam is talking about with children's violence and other things. The difference is COPPA, Child Online Protection Act, which was ruled unconstitutional by a district court a couple of weeks ago, was sort of like the frontier of government content regulation of the 1990s. And it took 10 years to get that finally, definitively, I believe, ruled unconstitutional. And now we're starting a whole new round of controls in other areas. What's interesting about the decision, the district court, and it was by no means unexpected, I think. The Supreme Court had signaled years ago that they thought that this act would be found unconstitutional. There was a preliminary injunction against enforcing it during all this time. But finally, the trial court had gone through its processes and reached its decision. And essentially, the legal points that it failed on were two of the main prongs of test of constitutionality. The act was not narrowly targeted to reach a purpose. In other words, it wasn't going to do what it was purportedly going needed to do to reach the goal of protecting children. And secondly, it was not the least restrictive alternative. That there are other alternatives out there, namely voluntary software that you can get for free from your ISP or from Windows Vista or buying independently. To take that out of legalese, if what the court ruled was this act was unnecessary and ineffective. And it goes to the heart of what's going on is even without the Constitution, you know, thank God we have that to protect us, but even without that, an act like this is unnecessary and ineffective. This simply is not what Congress should be doing. Just lastly, I want to mention that I guess the good news here is that there's been very little public outcry over this. I think 5-10 years ago, a decision like this would have been on the front page of every newspaper. Congress been jumping all over themselves to reenact it, to impeach the judge who signed the order, what have you. I think people accept now that it's somewhat difficult to control content as broadly as this did.
Although, James, I should mention that there has already been a legislative response, because just actually a few hours ago, Senators Mark Pryor of Arkansas and Max Baucus of Montana already introduced a new bill, they said, to fill in the gap for COPPA. Yeah, it's a new bill about labeling internet content. So instead of going with sort of age verification or sort of credit card validation, they're going to attempt to mandate labels for internet adult-oriented websites. This is an idea that Lawrence Lessig has been pushing for many, many years. But now Senators Pryor and Baucus have introduced this bill called the Cyber Safety for Kids Act of 2007 to try to supposedly fill in the gap left by COPPA's demise in the courts once again.
I think an important point here that's kind of relevant. COPPA is practically a reinvented version of the Child Decency Act, which failed to pass constitutional muster before COPPA. So, you know, I think it's likely they'll continue to try reinventing it and narrowing it until they finally get one that'll pass.
It could be, although there have been so many tests now in the courts. I mean, COPPA has gone to the Supreme Court twice and could go for a third time. It's been in numerous lower courts. The CDA, it was struck down. Several other state-based enactments have been struck down. You know, the fact is that we've got 10 years now of rock-solid jurisprudence that have gone against the government in each of these cases because of one key phrase, less restrictive means. The court in every case has said if there are less restrictive ways, less restrictive means of dealing with this at a household or parental level, then the government has to essentially allow those solutions to work. And what this latest COPPA decision found was that, and amazingly, it was the DOJ who introduced this evidence. The DOJ introduced evidence that filters, internet filters, worked 87.4% to 98.7% of the time to block sexually explicit material. And amazingly, the government suggested that that wasn't good enough. And the court said, I'm sorry, but that's pretty damn good. And I think a lot of people would agree, if it's catching anywhere near that, and the court basically concluded that it was an average of 95% of objectionable sexual material was blocked using filters, that's pretty good. After that, you have to think the parents can do the remaining 5% using other means.
I think James made a good point about this not being as much of a hot-button issue, and I think that's something you see with new technologies in general seem to be, it's much easier to scare people about them. I mean, you see you know, the current thing is MySpace, and I think that's just because that's newer. There's people, it's just less familiar to people. I think now that people are familiar with the internet and understand that, you know, the pornographic material doesn't just pounce on their children with no provocation whatsoever, I think they're more comfortable with the tools they have available and the ways they have to protect their kids.
That's exactly a point that I've been making as well, that the reaction has not been as strong to COPPA as you might think, but there's a lot of action that Adam's been writing about on the social networking sites and issues having to do with age verification that are almost an exact parallel to what was rejected in COPPA. But the big difference, again, is social networking sites are newer and therefore less familiar and therefore more scary to a lot of parents who don't understand them.
Speaking of labeling and filtering, .XXX, ICANN recently rejected the new domain. What do you guys think about that? Would have worked?
Well, just briefly, this is Adam. Just briefly, I'll say that obviously that was a difficult decision for ICANN to make. There were all sorts of tricky issues there about should a company be given the right to have a domain that so clearly was geared towards adult-oriented content. But that, in some ways, was the benefit of it as well, because some critics said, well, it'll create a virtual red light district online, but some proponents, like me, said, yeah, so what? That's not necessarily a bad thing. And then the sites that were at the XXX domain would have used embedded metadata labeling to label their other sites that were associated with the XXX sites to make it clear that they were adult sites, to make it even easier to filter out for those parents like me who wanted to do so. So I viewed it as a small but important step in the right direction, but it became such a hot-button issue with various family and religious groups, especially here in America, that it was obvious very early on that this thing was going to be killed and probably not going to come back.
I think a lot of people misunderstand the XXX domain issue. You know, I think it's worth noting that even the pornographers emphatically do not want it. In fact, I think the only organization that provided any vocal support for the proposal are the domain registrars who stand to profit from it. The pornographers are deathly afraid that if they end up with a .XXX domain, countries are going to start passing laws to force them to use it. You know, and while ICANN said, you know, the proposal to ICANN mostly focused on making it a voluntary thing, you know, there's still that concern hanging like a cloud over the entire process. And this is not the first time that, you know, that it's been rejected. You know, this is like an appeal because ICANN looked at it once before, and ICANN rejected it because they didn't want to be put into a position where they'd be forced by some laws to enforce it. So, you know, I think that it's also a solution in search of a problem. I really don't think it would be widely used even by pornographers, because they already have their current domain names and their current traffic and all that.
Yeah, it seems like kind of a reverse Baptist and bootleggers thing, where both the social conservatives, you know, don't want a change, and the pornographers don't want a change for opposite reasons. But I do think it's a real concern that if we sort of ghettoize pornographic sites in this one domain, it becomes, you know, one of the big arguments that we always make when people propose censoring websites is, well, how are you going to determine what's a pornographic website and what isn't? And like I think Ryan said, if you have a two-step process where you force you know, pornographic sites to go into this .XXX domain, and then you can start passing regulations restricting that. It's possible that would withstand court scrutiny more than the current system.
That's possible. You know, I don't know that much about how the market in this works, but I suspect, though, that most people that have pornographic material to sell want to be found, and they may have been flocking to a XXX domain rather than avoiding it. You know, if you have this to sell, it actually could be free advertising, such as an X-rated, you know, an X rating on a movie was something that was sought after, has been sought after by people with movies of that type.
On the other hand, though, I don't know how many people use domain names to find websites anymore. I think most people find, so in a sense, I don't think it really matters what domains people have, because most people go to Google and type in, you know, sex or naked or whatever. And so it's, I think the domain name is less important than your ranking in search engines.
All right, before we go, any other quick bit that caught your eye this week, guys?
Yeah, I just did a story about the European Union, which is looking at creating a they've been working since the 70s to create a unified patent system, and the most recent report from the European Commission proposes creating a unified patent court that would have jurisdiction over all European patents. And the disturbing thing about it was that the report did not show any real concern for avoiding the problems that the United States has been having with too generous terms for granting of patents and no real safeguards to ensure bad patents don't get granted. So hopefully that'll get revisited or won't get very far. I think there's been three efforts in the last three decades to set up a system like that, and so far they've all gone down in flames.
Well, let me mention, go ahead, there's a news item that did not happen this week, and that's the expansion of digital television converter box subsidies. Congress has apparently decided that it is to have it both ways. They have expanded the eligibility for the converter box subsidies, but are not expanding the money available. The theory actually is that people won't care that much about getting broadcast television, so they won't be turning in their coupons and buying converter boxes. So we'll see whether that's true or not. But strangely enough, they may have a point. I think there's a strong argument that people won't care about broadcasting, and the digital transition, when it takes place in a couple of years, will be a non-event.
But James, there isn't an entitlement, is there? I mean, it's just basically they'll give out boxes until the money runs out.
But the money, if money runs out, they will allocate more money.
They will.
You know, that's not in the law, but they're not going to be turning.
But it's a law of nature, huh?
That's right. A congressman will not turn down someone who wants to watch television. But remember, the latest formulation of this is not, you don't have a right to television. Your television has a right to receive signals. That's the way the broadcast is. But the right of television is not to televisions.
All right. Well, I wanted to talk about how the net neutrality issue is bleeding into the 700 megahertz auction. And you know, as you know, we're going to get back a lot of spectrum from the broadcasters with this digital television transition. We're going to get back 60 megahertz that the FCC has been told by Congress it has to auction off. But before it auctions the spectrum off, the FCC has to decide what service rules are applied to this auction. And we've got, you know, Frontline Wireless, which is a new company that's proposing to build a national public safety broadband network. They want to set out a 10 megahertz license that will be paired with public safety spectrum to build that network. But they want whoever is the winner of that auction, whoever is the successful bidder, to have to provide an open access network and basically have wireless Carter phone rules where any device can be attached to that spectrum. What I don't like about this is that this would require whoever is the successful bidder in the auction to use the spectrum for a particular business model. They wouldn't be able to decide for themselves what business to use. So if you buy a ton of steel today on the market, you can do whatever you want with the steel. You can build a car, you can build utensils, whatever you like. This way, you're buying some spectrum at auction, and you can't do whatever you want with it. The FCC, the government, is telling you what is a business model that you have to employ. And we also have a new coalition called the Save Our Spectrum Coalition, which I believe is headed up by the New America Foundation, and also includes our friends at Public Knowledge and the Media Access Project and others. And they filed a petition, I think it's last week, asking that the service rules for I think it's James. Maybe you can tell me. I think it's like half of the spectrum, maybe all of it, that's going to be auctioned. That should also include some wireless card or phone requirements.
That's right. That's right. I think it was 30 out of the remaining 60, I believe.
Right, and they say, quote, you know, either prohibit. This is something else that they're requiring, or that they are asking for in their petition. They say, quote, either prohibit wireline and large wireless incumbents from bidding, or require them to bid through structurally separate affiliates. So basically, sort of stipulating that there is a competition problem here. One thing I'd like to get the reaction from you guys on is one thing that they are asking for. They're saying that the commission should also guard against winners of the spectrum auction keeping the spectrum from being used by not constructing new services. And sort of their theory here is that a lot of the spectrum out there now that was auctioned off is not being put to use. And what they fear is that a big incumbent will buy up spectrum solely so that a new entrant won't be able to have it, and they can do that with their deep pockets, and then just sit on it. What do you guys think about that?
You know, that was a big issue at the FCC for years, that so-called warehousing question. And frankly, warehousing only makes sense if there's a limited amount of resource that you're going to warehouse. So the solution for the FCC is instead of putting in rules against warehousing, which, by the way, there's a lot of good economic reasons why you want to leave land vacant. That's why there's vacant lots in every big city at all times. But the solution for the FCC is to make more and more spectrum available, get more spectrum out there so that your warehousing does not keep a competitor out.
It becomes a moot issue.
One thing I want to add also, I haven't heard anyone talking about this yet, but the frontline petition, at least the rules, I don't know about the whole thing, but it was written by an attorney here in town, Henry Goldberg, who's a long-standing telecom attorney. He also happens to be the attorney who wrote the Skype petition. So these two things are tied together closely, I think.
And the Skype petition, of course, is asking the FCC to apply wireless card or phone rules to existing wireless carriers. All right, well, that's going to have to do it for Tech Policy Weekly this time. Thanks to James Cattuso, Tim Lee, Adam Thierer, and Ryan Paul for joining us. Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
Thank you.
To read more commentary from our panelists and the rest of the Technology Liberation Front gang, visit us at techliberation.com. Also, if you have something to say about something we said, you can post a comment on the website. Just go to techliberation.com/podcast, and you can leave a comment on the page for this show. If you'd like what you heard, please tell a friend, please write a review of the show on iTunes, and don't forget to dig our podcast. Until next week, I'm Jerry Brito. Bye-bye.